Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Us speculating why Israeli food was going to be the next thing was like just so we could get a bunch of money to open an Israeli restaurant.
I mean, a lot of times a business plan is just window dressing on a gut feeling that you have.
This week and next, we're going to take deep dives into the lives of two people who have left an indelible imprimatur on both the Philadelphia food scene and the American food culture. James Beard Award-winning executive chef, owner Michael Solomonov, and his longtime restaurateur partner, Stephen Cook. Together they own Zahav, Federal Donuts, Diesengoff, Abe Fisher, Goldie, and the Rooster Soup Company in Philadelphia. And unusually, they write cookbooks together, which is kind of weird, right? Very few chef restaurateur teams write cookbooks together.
We've never done it any other way, so it seems normal
to us. Got
it.
We do everything together.
They've written three, to be exact, including their newest tome, Israeli Soul. So welcome to Special Sauce.
Thanks for having us, Ed.
Yeah, it's good. It's great for you guys to be here. There's so much I want to get into, so we're going to dive right in. First of all, Michael, tell us how your partnership with Stephen started.
So we met because Steve's fiance at the time and now his wife and I grew up together. Her name is Shira, and she and I grew up together in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh. I was born in Israel but grew up in Pittsburgh. My mom was a teacher at a Solomon Schechter school there, and Shira was her student. And so we grew up kind of together. And I was leaving Vetri Restaurant in 2005. Right, October is when I started with you. But we met, I guess, in the summer. Mm-hmm. And I get a call from Shira, I guess, saying, will you meet my husband or my fiancé? Or maybe you texted me, but you had called Vetri separately, independently, right?
Yeah, I had spoken to Mark because I had a restaurant where I was the chef and looking to replace myself in the kitchen.
Yeah, but I think like that. It's the best feeling in the world, isn't it? You can fire yourself.
Steve wanted to fire himself, but you had called Mark, and Mark had sort of mentioned it to me, but I don't think you called. You didn't.
I didn't
ask him
call
about
you.
Me.
We had been hearing. We were the two Jewish line cooks in Philadelphia.
There were no other.
And so we've been hearing
you
about each
the
other.
Two Jewish line cooks in Philadelphia. I like that.
And we lived next door to each other without ever meeting.
Yeah, we lived by the art museum area.
That's
literally
funny.
In apartments that were next to each other. We had never met. I had heard that there was a nice Jewish, blonde Jewish kid that also cooked. And his dad was a rabbi or something. And he'd probably heard about me. And then, so Shira had reached out to me and said, do you want to like have coffee or something? And I was like, okay. And then Mark had mentioned it. So we met, and then, you know, I think it took was that I like knew Shira's family and was like Jewish, and then I got the job. Well, I was working at Vetri too, so it seemed
you had some skills.
It seemed like it, and he knew what I was doing. And then I was excited because I staged one night, and I just was like, you know, it was really refined food and for the time. And it was a perfect little, there was like three cooks or something, including the chef. And Steve's sauce work was like really tight. And I was used, you know, I had worked at Vetri for 3 years. So our sauce work was like pasta water, butter, Parmesan cheese, which is awesome.
Yeah, delicious.
You know, but I remember this, it was like hangar steak with like artichokes, like barigol or whatever. And then it was this sort of like beef, red wine, horseradishy kind of jus, and then this like buttermilk, blue cheese, like butter. And it was just so, you know, it was just tight, you know. And then there was, it was like this like pork loin with this like five spice. And it was, there was like a tiny circulator too. And I wasn't, sous vide cooking was just starting to get
right.
Really exciting. And it was like sliced plums in this like, in brick dough with like pulled pork shoulder with like plum sauce wrap.
Got
so it was fun and tight and beautiful, and it was a very small kitchen.
So you felt like simpatico with what Steve was cooking.
Well, I thought that the food was great, and I thought that like the kitchen was perfect, and it seemed gentle enough and small enough where, and I was excited to be a chef. I thought that I could cook
After being a line cook for so long.
Well, line cook or sous chef or working for people, I think I was ready to, like, make my own food. And Steve had made it very clear that he wasn't looking to, like, manage any of the food, anything like that. And I think at the time you were like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but, like, the kitchen is yours.
Right? I didn't come to the restaurant for a couple of months. I mean, it was a hard year for me. It was my second career. I'd left a career in finance and cooked.
Smart move, man. Boring.
Well, wait, what did you say? It was just too much money.
Right. It was I liked the hours, but the money was too much. So I had fallen in love with cooking, and I decided to make it my career. And then finally, I had my own restaurant. And after a year, I was just burned. I'd burned myself out, and I was feeling a little bit desperate because I was like, this is the second career that I've been through, and it hasn't really taken. And so I didn't come to the restaurant for a while, which. Fortunately, Mike was like, Mike was responsible.
He
with
was
the
thrilled.
Restaurant. Yeah,
the boss didn't show up.
Well, it was sort of like I never. It wasn't like that though. I mean, I think Steve made it really clear that he didn't want. And I know that he probably could anticipate what my fear would be, or what anybody's fear would be, is that it's like, come in and do the menu, but I'm gonna like
micromanage.
We don't do that with anybody that works for us now at all. There's no restaurants where we're like. Do whatever you want. See you in a couple months, you know? So I think that, but I also think that you needed to figure out like what you wanted to do and what your role was. And it came along with like answering phones, cleaning the place up, doing all the construction, looking at the book. You hadn't looked at a P&L or even balanced anything for the year that you had been open, right?
Right. We didn't have books for the year that we were open because I was in the kitchen.
So how do you move from the world of finance, which... I mean, I have an MBA, I have to say, not proudly, and I'm allergic to numbers, and it was one of the problems with Serious Eats, right? Cause I'm actually writing a Serious Eats memoir now that was due to the publisher a couple of weeks ago, but don't get into it.
Yeah. You're like, I'm not a numbers or a words guy.
No, I'm a words person, but it's fascinating to me that you were a finance guy who didn't have books. I think you, it's too bad I didn't know about you. I would have hired you at Serious Eats.
Perfect.
I would have loved that. I don't know. I mean, I was too busy running the restaurant to look at invoices. I assumed wrongly that what I found being a cook is the restaurant feels incredibly busy. And then you get to the end of the service and they're like, well, how many covers did we do? We did 25 covers. And they're like, I can't. And it just seemed like it was so busy. So I just assumed because I was so busy that we were doing okay. And then only when I started to take a closer look, when I had time and came back to the restaurant and Mike was running it, I realized that we needed to have some controls. And, you know, that restaurant, I think, has launched a lot of careers, but it was never a moneymaker.
Yeah, interesting. So, you know, I don't think we explore enough on Special Sauce the exact nature of the chef-restaurateur relationship. And you're more than a restaurateur because you obviously have spent time in the kitchen, which must really help in terms of gluing you together.
Well, we sort of say this, and it is true and continues. The more we grow, the larger we become, the more our jobs or what our roles should be sort of integrate, you know? And I've learned a lot. I mean, Steve has been a mentor to me. Obviously, I didn't have any sort of formal training in finance I can't even really build a spreadsheet.
Neither can I.
Right. That's good. It's good to have people that can do that shit.
Yeah.
Excuse me. But I find that, and everyone thinks that I'm like the chef and I cook every single meal in every one of our restaurants. And that Steve is like independently wealthy and like, you know, I don't know what they think that you do. Like or some people think you're like front of the house or whatever. But it's not, you know, that's just not the way that it works. And it is a true partnership. And we are equally on the hook for things when they go wrong. And I think that we just, I don't know, we've learned how to grow together and how to remove ego. And sort of when we're like bleeding, we bleed together. And at this point, we've done this long enough where if we don't like something, we're comfortable talking about it. Like it's safe. We encourage it. I mean, we still have a problem with it, but with our team and certainly with our managers, the last thing that we want are for people to just like agree with us.
Yeah. So give us an example of the way you two work together to solve problems.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think
or not.
Well, the traditional restaurant partner paradigm is more back of house, front of house. And I always say that if you see me in the front of the house of one of our restaurants during service, then something has gone horribly wrong. But, you know, like Mike said, I think we, on the one hand, we make all the decisions together, and Mike's got a great head for making business decisions, and I try to put myself in his shoes now since we've been working together for so long. I also think we share the same values. And we speak the same language because we come from the kitchen, but I remember very distinctly it was during that period where I was just staying away from the restaurant, and I get a call from Mike one day, and he's like, you know, and we had a general manager who was basically running the business of the restaurant, and I remember Mike saying, like, you know, we don't have enough cash to pay the dishwasher. He's like, this isn't right. We got it. And, like, I guess the general manager told the dishwasher, like, just wait a couple days or something, and Mike called me, and he's like, this isn't right. And I felt, like, sort of, like, a little bit ashamed, but also felt like, okay, here's a guy that – he's absolutely right. Here's a guy that, like – and that's kind of when I mean, that's one of the moments, I think, when I knew, like – you know, we have the same set of values. And then, you know, opening Zahav, I think, was probably the biggest challenge that we've gone through. I mean, we were, for a long time, I kept a check that Mike's dad wrote us. It was a $10,000 check because we thought we were going to miss the next payroll. We fortunately never had to cash it, but that was the most...
We should have hung on to that check, you
know? But, you know, when I read the Zahav book again recently to prepare for the interview, I realized that, you know, you went through what everyone goes through when they're starting a business, right? Which is you are right on the precipice of going under at some point, you know, and it's a matter of do you furlough your own salary or do you close the business, you know? And it's because that happened with Serious Eats.
We weren't taking salaries at that point either.
Right.
We had no salaries and we were going to close the business and we were squeaking along to really make payroll to stay open. And it forced us to be really diligent and to think about our priorities. And actually, in a way, it freed us too. That was when Zahav, like the food or the way that we cook now sort of came to fruition, which was like one day Steve saying, I don't know why you're making this so traditional, like just kind of cook. There's nothing, we have nothing to lose. Like we're probably going to close, right?
Right.
Just like be a chef. You
There's
know?
Nothing like the desperation of
yes.
impending failure that to sharpen your focus.
It's,
on what...
it is amazing. I can tell you from the Serious Eats perspective that nothing
almost...
focused me more when I realized, okay, I could lose my apartment if I can't pay this loan. You know, it's like.
And what did you do?
What did I do? I squeaked along and often furloughed my salary, risked many things, including my treasured relationship with my fantastic wife. And I think everyone has the same stories. It's really, really hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to do anything, whether it's a small restaurant. You know, I was doing this blog as a business. First of all, everyone was like that, you know, like Jeffrey Steigart said, are you crazy? You're not going to do your stories at the Times anymore? And I was like, no. I'm going to do this. Like, this is the future, and I'm just going to go for it. And then, you know, I'd raise money. And I was going to ask you guys how you raise money for Zahav. I bet it's the same story. And it'd be like, and then so I would go to people that, friends and literally friends and family, and like, so who's doing this now? Nobody. So how do you know it's going to work? It's going to be great. You know, like, the most compelling argument I could make was, it's going to be great.
Yeah. It's funny, though. It's funny when it is great, when it does work, and you haven't, like, gone under or worse, and you look back and you're like, this was all – it was fodder to, like, raise money, and we thought that it made a compelling story, but, like, we had no idea the things that we projected, specifically with Zahav, because I remember, you know, Steve is, like, brilliant and extremely organized and – in terms of raising capital, he can do it. I mean, he knows how to do it. But I remember there were these like anecdotal things. It was like Israel, like the Middle East, like nobody, it's like not yet discovered, you know? And then it was like in the same breath, it was like, why one out of five restaurants close? And he was basically anticipating all of these like things.
Yeah, micro and macro questions.
Well, it was funny though, because like us speculating why Israeli food was going to be the next thing was like just so we could get a bunch of money to open an Israeli restaurant.
Well, that was the same thing with me telling people that food blogs were going to be the next thing.
Right. I mean, a lot of times a business plan is just window dressing on a gut feeling that you have.
Yes, for sure. And in the end, people invest in other people. They don't invest in a business plan.
Right. When I think about all the advantages that we have when we open a project today, the network of trusted professionals that we've built and the ease of access to capital on a relative basis, what we don't have is that like that fire that we had when you're unproven, when nobody will give you a shot that, you know, that basically forces you to succeed at all costs. And so I miss that sometimes.
The opening of Zahav like definitely took 10 years off of our life.
Yeah, yeah. Did your Wharton background help or really prepare you in any way?
It did. I mean, I could speak the language that people needed to hear to feel comfortable parting with.
That was the thing I tell people I learned at Columbia Business School was I learned a language.
That's right.
That's it.
And it's I think it goes the same in the kitchen, because if I didn't have a kitchen background, I couldn't. We have 200 employees, you know, half of them roughly back of the house. Like, how could you manage people if you can't speak their language?
Right.
And so I think it's all a lot of it is about language.
Yeah. And you did have the culinary background as well. So that must have helped, not just the partnership, but in getting the restaurant off the ground.
You would think.
So first of all, we should tell people about Zahav, which was a contemporary and still is a contemporary Israeli, I would say an Israeli-American restaurant, you know, the same way all restaurants are hyphenated these days. But certainly it was the first restaurant in this country where you were saying to customers, pay attention to the food of Israel.
Yes.
And that were so much more than falafel and whatever else you've experienced. So talk a little bit about that, because it must have been, I don't care how much background Stephen has in raising money. It's like to convince people when Zahav opened that Israeli food was going to be the next big thing was not easy.
It was not easy. And I think that the idea of it just kept, it was from going back to Israel and visiting my family and experiencing what dining there was like. And then coming back to the States, you know, and like tinkering with like chicken skin wrapped around sweetbreads and taking things apart and dissecting and being molecular. And I was like, I don't understand. This is not as exciting as what you get at like any restaurant in Israel. And it doesn't taste as good. And it's definitely not as healthy. And there are 100 different cultures represented in Israel.
I know. It's your books that made me realize what an immigrant cuisine Israeli cuisine is.
Well, it's all happened in such a quick period
of
time.
Exactly, because it's all from 1948 on, right?
Well, I mean, not exactly. It's before that, but like not by much in relative terms, you know? And it's also still happening. Like there's people that are moving. There's also, I think that and only in food, there's a conversation happening between Israelis and Palestinians that doesn't really happen on the surface. It's happening, like people are delving into these things, and hopefully in the next couple of years, it's a form of recognized diplomacy.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it was something that we wanted to do, but the style of eating as well, the all the natural fuel, all the sharing, all the vegetable forward cooking, those are things that are like we all Americans love. We all want to eat that way. Right? Mm-hmm. We all want to share.
Sure.
I want small plates, you know, and tapas was like killing it at the time. And that was the way that we could kind of sell it to people. It was like small plates and bites, and it did work. And I think at the end of the day, like when you make fresh laffa and cook it in a wood burning oven and serve it
you
with
should
like,
explain what laffa is.
Laffa is like a Iraqi style pita, similar to naan, actually. And it's sort of like stretchy, but also crisp. And we soak ours with like olive oil and za'atar, and then you, which is za'atar is like a herbaceous spice blend that has got sumac and sesame. And if you take bread that is like out of a wood burning oven for less than, you know, 10 seconds or whatever, and then you tear a piece off and dip it into like a hummus that is made like, you know, al manut basically, There is nothing better than that. There's no amount of tinkering. There's no...
So, like, why is there no hummus on the table right now?
There should be,
right?
You
guys bought nothing.
I know.
I just want to say this to all the listeners out there. These guys brought zero.
Well, Zahav is like an hour and 20-minute train ride from here, okay?
But you did actually... Your hummus is one of those things where it's like, oh, that's what hummus is supposed to taste like. You know, people, chefs don't get to leave that imprimatur on a food. So if you, and you, for me at least, mm-hmm. when I had your hummus for the first time in Philadelphia at the original Dizengoff, or maybe it's a Havad, I can't remember, but it was like, oh, that's what hummus is supposed to taste like.
It's very good hummus, you know.
It's excellent hummus.
And that was like, that's the first bite that people get when they come to the restaurant, you know? And then they get like six or eight or like little salad team that cover, you know, eight different cultures. And then they get tons of like little mezes. And then they get meat that's cooked, you know, or fish or vegetable cooked in the style of meat over charcoal, you know? And it's like that is that kind of celebration of food and cultures and definition of Israeli cuisine is what we do, you know? I mean, Israeli soul, coming back to the book, is like, that's what we do. We want to transport people. We want them to live and breathe and taste these experiences that span, in some cases, thousands of years.
Got it. So at what moment, because there is a moment in every business, restaurant, website, blog, doesn't matter, where it's like, is this going to go south or are we gonna make it? Like, what was that moment for you guys?
We live that moment every day.
for Zahav in particular, I guess it would have been, what was it, January of 2009? Or was it September of 2008?
When I asked my dad for money?
No, when we had restaurant week for the first time.
That was in January 2009,
So restaurant week, like, it was a fixed format.
Right, promotion. Whatever, 19, whatever.
And there were other small plates restaurants, but Zahav's menu really didn't fit. And so, but we wanted to participate because we couldn't afford not to have that traffic. I mean, we had no traffic, so anything was better than nothing. And at the time, you know, we opened with a menu. We write about it in the Zahav book. We were with a menu that had Hebrew words with no English, you know, transliterated into English letters, but with no explanations. And we were really confusing the hell out of our guests. Anyways, we said we have to do restaurant week. We've got to like fit it into this value profile. How do we format the menu that'll work? And it really forced us to sit there and think about it, I think, maybe for the first time from the guest's perspective. And we actually ended up using that template. Restaurant week was like a breath of fresh air. The restaurant was busy, which felt good. And
it's always nice to have people in the seats, isn't it?
Well, at that time too, we were like not used to it, and we needed it.
And the, you know, the guests were happy, the cooks were busy, and for the first time, the guests weren't sort of, you know, paralyzed by how to deal with this menu. We were sort of showing them, okay, you choose essentially one from column A, one from column B, one from column C.
Well, everybody started with salad team and hummus,
and you start with this amazing introduction, you know, that sort of, you know, if. Close your ears, Mike. But like, you know, most people come in and they get the salad team and the hummus, and then like everything else after that is terrible. They're still going to enjoy their experience at Zahav. Not that it is terrible,
right? So restaurant week really, you know, most restaurateurs and chefs hate restaurant weeks, right? Because we have to adhere to the strict format. We can't make any money, or the only way we can make money is by selling super cheap food. And so for you, though, restaurant week was kind of a light bulb revelation moment.
It was sort of a life preserver for us. It gave us a roadmap of how we should the guest experience, where they didn't have to make so many hard choices. We were sort of laying it out for them. I mean, I think, you know, restaurant week, restaurants are always better. Your food cost is always lower when you're busy. You know, employees are always happier when they're busy, even if they might say otherwise. And so I would, restaurant week's been, was very instrumental in getting Zahav, you know, having Zahav take flight.
And did the business, the number of regular covers, increase substantially after that restaurant week?
So it actually took a little bit more time than that, but it allowed us to get comfortable to give the customers what they wanted and to get people back into the restaurant that, like, gave us a shot in the beginning. I remember, though, for that specifically, it was, like, freezing cold out. And we looked – I guess it was – was it 1 week or 2 weeks?
It was probably 1 week at that time.
It was 1 week, and we, like, made money for the first time ever, you know? And it was, like, we'd made, like – $6,000 or something, and then our hot water heater went out, and it was like $12,000 to repair.
Yeah, there's that moment. There's that moment in every situation. It's so weird.
Well, and then we got, I think, a nomination for Mid-Atlantic or something like that.
A beard nomination.
No, beard nomination in April and May, and then Philly Mag came in.
Right. The Philadelphia Magazine had started the previous year. It started their list of the 50 best restaurants in.
Oh,
Philly.
I guess I got the nomination the year. It was the year later, right?
Yeah. And so we were, and Zaha was number one, and that
got
was
it.
Us. That
was
opened
huge.
The floodgates.
Got
right?
it. So, you know, you've had all this tremendous success, and yet, Michael, I want to turn to you and your history for just a few minutes. You know, I mean, you are very honest in the Zaha book about the adversity and even tragedy that you deal with, and you know, you talk in the book about what happened with your brother mm-hmm. and, you know, your acknowledged problem with some substance abuse. Like, how did those experiences come together that sort of enabled you to deal with all this?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, there's a lot there. There's there is grief, and I lost my brother. He was 21 and serving in a infantry unit in Israel, and it was like 3 days before his release, and it was on Yom Kippur, and it was like obviously tragic and traumatic.
And you'd had this rapprochement with him after being estranged for a few years, right?
We'd spent a lot of time together the month before, and I was working at Vetri at the time, and it was awful. I mean, it was like the war, you know, one of the worst things that could have really happened. But that sort of made me understand, I guess, well, I felt a lot more Israeli mm-hmm. at that point. And I had gone through a couple of years where I'd like lived in Israel and then moved back. And once we had moved back to Israel when I was much younger, when I was 15, there was something about it that I could never really shake, mm-hmm. you know, because it was really part of who I was, and was such an important year, and it really shaped a lot of the way that I, you know, a lot of the things that were important to me. And then after David died, it was just like, well, I can't ignore this thing now. And it wasn't like I was like, I'm going to open an Israeli restaurant to honor my brother, but that's, you know, in some way that kind of happened. And at least with my relationship to the country, it happened. And I took Mark Vetri, who I was working for at the time, to Israel to cook a tribute dinner to him for the rest of his unit. And Mark came back from that trip like affected by it. And I felt like maybe that was sort of the light bulb, like, well, I can't bring people to Israel. I mean, I can, but not the frequency in which I would like. And maybe by representing, and it started really after Steve hired me. It was like, I'll cook food, and like Israeli stuff came on the menu, and people recognized it as being Israeli, and they could make the association from my background mm-hmm. to why there was like Yemenite soup spice on like braised monkfish tails.
Yeah,
you know, and I was like, all right, well, it's people get it. You know, there's a correlation, and that's just kind of what happened. I mean, my relationship to Israel obviously wouldn't be what it is without bearing my younger brother there.
Wow, and Stephen, did you feel when you guys connected, did you feel his vulnerability and his pain?
I was certainly aware of David's story. I think I remember Boris calling me the day that it happened, which is a friend we had in common.
One Shira must have known through everybody from
right.
Pittsburgh, too.
But, I mean, by the time we actually met and started working together, maybe I was just being naive or sort of oblivious, but it didn't feel like it was it was certainly a part of who Mike was, but it wasn't. Maybe not until sort of Zaha did it become play a bigger role in the relationship and the business, because, you know, Marigold was an existing restaurant, and the sort of Israeli influences that Mike brought to the menu were brought upon gradually.
Yeah. It seems like you almost, and maybe it's in part from David dying, that you guys have seem like brothers. And not that Stephen has replaced him, but it seems like you needed a connection to somebody like that.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. You know, I do. I mean, I refer to Steve as obviously my best friend, but also a brother. And I think that what also happened, I mean, you know, I've also been very open about drug addiction. I mean, things got progressive,
yeah.
Right, afterwards. But I don't want to confuse, like, if anybody's listening to this that is struggling with addiction, it wasn't like David's death that made me, like, start doing, like, crack and heroin.
Right.
You know, the addiction part of it was always kind of there waiting.
Right.
I mean, people go through tragedy all the time. It doesn't make them necessarily turn into drug addicts. So, you know, it in a way, like, the addiction kind of needed that to happen, and it did. And Steve, as a friend and business partner and brother, was the first to be supportive and to say, literally, we know you have a problem and we want you to get help. And this was when Zahav was like 4 months old or something like that, 3 months old. Well, we had invested everything we'd had in each other, and he'd found out that his business partner of 2 years was hiding like a crack and heroin addiction.
Wow. So, that's an extraordinary story.
I needed that. I mean, I couldn't really. I leaned on Steve, and leaned is a very light way of putting it. I mean, he literally drove me, would pick me up in the morning from a 12-step meeting and drive me into work every day for like a year. I couldn't be by myself. And my wife at the time would pick me up every single night and drive me home, you know, and I literally couldn't do anything by myself. And while that was happening, the restaurant was like tanking, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course. I mean, that is, it, you know, you talk about resilience. I mean, it was like, I don't view it as like being strong at all. It's literally about like understanding your weakness and vulnerability and saying, I need help.
Yeah.
I like asking for help or being honest about how incredibly messed up you are is a very difficult thing.
Yeah.
And going to people that you've lied to and cheated and manipulated and like asking for forgiveness is a difficult, that, you know, that sort of like shame, it's unfortunately correlated right back to your desire to want to pick up. So having to be honest and be like, I messed up and I am this like piece of dirt that, you know, I pretended to not be. It's a very difficult thing to do that. Look at somebody that you've relied on, that you manipulated, and then in the same sort of breath, ask them for something again, you know?
Yeah.
So,
wow. Pretty intense. Guys, the clock says we have to wrap up this week's podcast. Next week, we'll get to the new book, Israeli Soul, and the Rooster Soup Company. So thanks up till now.
Thanks, yeah.
Thanks.
And so long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.